Okay, I think we're ready to kick off this session. Today we will have four speakers who will provide an overview of EPA's draft handbook for developing watershed plans to restore and protect our waters. The first speaker will be Charlie McPherson, who is with Tetra Tech. Charlie has developed and implemented public outreach strategies for state, tribal, and local watershed organizations for the past 15 years. Good afternoon, Charlie.
Thanks, Juan. Hello to everyone out there in webcast land. Now, as most of you know, watershed planning is a truly collaborative process that involves many different skill sets and areas of expertise. So today, instead of just having one speaker, we have a cast of characters who will help address various aspects in the watershed planning process. And I just want to briefly introduce them all to you now. If you go to slide number 2, I'm there in the upper right, and Stuart Lehman in further down on the left. He's with EPA's Nonpoint Source Control Branch, and he's led the development of the handbook. And he's going to be giving us EPA's perspective on the development of the handbook and why EPA felt it was needed. Further down, you'll see Leslie Shoemaker of Tetra Tech. Leslie's a water resources engineer, and she specializes in developing and implementing watershed models to help calculate the pollutant loads in the watershed and to help identify the best management practices that should be used to reduce those loads. And then finally, certainly last but not least, Barry Tawning on the bottom. Barry's also with Tetra Tech, and Barry specializes in the actual on-the-ground implementation of management practices and evaluating the effectiveness of those practices. So you're going to be hearing from all of them in today's webcast. If you go to slide number 3, I just want to give you a little roadmap of what we're going to be doing today. Obviously, in the 2 hours that we have, we can't cover all of the nuances of watershed planning. So we've structured the webcast around the major steps in the watershed planning process. And what we've done is to identify some of the most commonly asked questions that we hear in each of these steps. And we're going to show you how the handbook can help address these questions. Okay, moving on to number 4, I just want to briefly give you an overview of the handbook. For those of you who haven't seen it, it is 414 pages. It includes 13 chapters. The chapters proceed sequentially through the watershed planning and implementation process. Now, it's important we didn't stop with just development of a watershed plan. And so the handbook continues through implementation and evaluation. The handbook also is not meant to be read sequentially. I've heard from a lot of people, wow, it's really big. Well, yes, it is, but what we've done deliberately is to provide shortcuts and descriptions of what's inside each chapter so that you can easily flip back and forth to find out what you're most interested in. In addition, we've included a lot of worksheets and checklists throughout the document so that you can modify these to your own needs. And finally, we've included a resource section in the end that's broken up by various topics, such as modeling, monitoring, public outreach, where you can go to for more detailed information. Because we recognize that there's a lot of good watershed-related information out there, and instead of duplicating that information, we refer you to places where you can get it in more detail. All right, if we can move on to number 5, what I want to do in the next few slides is just provide an overview of the watershed planning process and set the foundation for the rest of today's webcast. Now, there's lots of different ways you can present the process, and we see lots of different shapes. Here on slide 5, we see the wheel graphic developed by Ohio EPA. Starting at the top of the wheel, the very first step, building public support, extremely important. Moving clockwise around the wheel, you start to define your problems. Once you know what your problems are, you set goals and develop solutions. And then you develop an action plan of how you're going to solve those problems. You implement your plan and evaluate. pretty straightforward. Again, if you go to slide number 6, we have the triangle graphic. This is developed by Tom Davenport at EPA Region 5, but same steps. In the upper left, you have phase 1, defining the problem, moving on to phase 2, set the goals, identify solutions. Phase 3, you're going to implement your management practices. And phase 4, you're going to see if they're working. And so there are commonalities, obviously, to each of these approaches. Moving on to slide 7, you can see we've taken the game board approach. And starting at build partnerships, very first thing you're going to do, we move on to step 2, which is characterize the watershed. And this is where you're going to define your problems. Again, moving on to 3, set your goals, identify solutions, design your program, implement it, measure progress, and make those adjustments as you're evaluating and monitoring the progress to improve your plan. It's very important. Your plan is not a static plan. It's going to change. And if you move on to number 8, the entire process of watershed planning is an iterative process. And so we're going to go through the steps today sequentially. But in reality, when you're doing watershed planning, you actually have to go back and revisit some of the previous steps. And we highlight in the handbook where this is most likely to occur. And so we give you a little heads up on that. Moving on to number 9, what I'm going to do in the next several slides is just quickly go through each one of these steps. And then later on, the other presenters will break these down into greater detail. So the first step here, we've already talked about it, build partnerships. This is critical to do at the beginning for the sustainability of your watershed effort, because usually the solutions that are identified to be implemented are going to be at the local level. So obviously you need the participation at the local level and of these stakeholders up front. Moving on to slide number 10, characterize the watershed. This is where you're going to identify what the problems are, where they are coming from, and the extent of those problems. And Leslie Shoemaker will be talking about this step. Moving on to slide 11, step 3, she's also going to be covering this step. This is finalize goals and identify solutions. And I say finalize goals because in step 1, you've probably already identified some preliminary goals with your stakeholders, and this is where you will refine the goals based on having more information. This is also where you're going to identify which management strategies you'll need to implement to achieve your goals. Moving on to slide 12, step 4, designing your implementation program. This is where you're going to really hammer out the nuts and bolts, sorry for the tool reference here, of your implementation program. This is your action plan, your to-do list. You're going to figure out who's going to do what, by when, how you're going to pay for it, what kind of technical assistance is needed, how you're going to measure progress, etc. Okay, moving on to 13. In step 5, at this point, you've developed your watershed plan, but now you have to implement it. So in this step, you're going to implement those management practices and monitor to see if they're meeting your goals and conduct outreach. And this is where outreach and education is extremely important to effectively implement many of these practices, as well as to make people aware of the watershed effort and to let them know how they can participate in this process for implementation. But outreach is also included in step 1. Moving to slide 14. Finally, in step 6, this is where you're going to review your monitoring information to see if you need to make changes. Are you seeing progress? If not, why not? And this is called adaptive management. And this is where, remember, the plan is a living document, and it needs to be constantly reviewed and refined as you get more information and as you complete various activities. So remember, it's not a static document. Now on slide 15, this is taken straight out of the handbook, but I just want to show you this is the entire process that I've just gone through, steps 1 through 6. And this is where you can see after step 4, with the arrows going out to the right, you have your watershed plan document, and it feeds back into the implementation. So it does not stop with the development of the plan. It's going to reinforce that over and over. Now, moving on to slide 16, many of you have heard of these 9 elements. What are these 9 elements? Well, EPA identified some common elements that they felt should be included in all watershed plans where water bodies are either threatened or impaired. Now, generally, most of these elements are already included in the watershed planning process. They are not new things. And for the most part, it's just common sense. For example, A, identify causes and sources of pollution. Well, obviously, you need to identify the causes and sources before you can develop solutions. Moving at F, develop a schedule. You need to know what you're going to do by when. G, describe interim measurable milestones. How will you know if you're making progress or not? Now, I use A through I on the slide because that's how they appear in EPA's guidelines. And I found that more and more people now, they say, now, number H, or, you know, letter H. So I just have kept that terminology. And Stuart's going to be talking a little bit more about these when he talks in a bit. So moving to 17, which is going back to the slide I showed earlier in the watershed planning process, where do those 9 elements come into play? And if you go to number 18, I've highlighted those sections with the red arrows so that you can see they start in number 2, characterizing the watershed. That's where you identify the causes and sources, and they appear in step 3. And most of them are in your implementation program, because this is where we've seen the greatest deficiency, where people don't have a schedule, they don't have a monitoring component, they're not measuring progress and feeding it back. So that's where most of the elements occur. We also highlight in the handbook where one of these elements is discussed specifically. So I hope this gives you a bit of a foundation for the watershed planning process and how it's outlined in the handbook. And now Stuart Lehman is going to provide EPA's perspective on this handbook. Stuart?
Thanks, Charlie. As Charlie said, I work here in the EPA's non-point source program in the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds, the Office of Water here in Washington, D.C. From the non-point source perspective, we have been funding watershed projects for more than 15 years with our 319 funds. These funds go to the regions, to the tribes, and through the states, ultimately to local watershed projects that are working to implement state and tribal non-point source management plans. But there are other programs in EPA who have been more recently looking at how their programs can be integrated using a watershed approach. For instance, estuary programs, TMDL developers have been doing this and looking at watershed-based TMDLs. Wastewater permitters have been looking at how a watershed approach can help them accomplish their goals. Drinking water, it's also being understood even more now that drinking water programs and surface water programs can be integrated. So watershed-based analysis and planning here at EPA is a common thread for pulling our programs together. So what are we learning about watershed efforts across the country? First, watershed problems are not spread evenly across the landscape. There are hot spots that need key actions to solve them. There's a growing vast body of knowledge on BMP effectiveness. EPA has management measures on urban sources for flow alteration, what we call hydromod. We have management measure guides from forestry and ag and other sources of non-point source pollution. There's also a growing body of knowledge on assessment tools such as modeling, mapping, and databases. The idea of this guide is provide a roadmap on how to find those at the right stage in your watershed planning process. We've also found at EPA that partnerships are imperative, but how does one organize and manage complex cleanup efforts more effectively? How do you know if you're achieving your goals unless you're monitoring for them? So that's one thing that we key on here in our watershed handbook, how to set up the appropriate monitoring program. And then with that data, you can provide the necessary feedback to keep that watershed plan alive and to let's switch to the next slide. This handbook, slide 20, this handbook should assist watershed organizations with implementing EPA's funding guidelines for 319 grants. Since 1999, around 99 or 2000, EPA has been spending more than half of its funds on funding watershed projects. Watershed plans are more than likely going to have more than just the nine elements. We expect them to have an element of protection, to look at drinking water if that's an issue in the watershed, to identify ways to protect key habitats, fisheries, and there are going to be state priorities, tribal priorities, and local priorities that are going to play a role in what's actually going to be in a watershed plan. We expect there to be different plans in the eastern parts of the country as well in the western parts of the country. Now, there are three particular elements that identify underneath the first bullet that we found that watershed groups, watershed organizations would like help with. The first one is quantifying pollution sources to guide plan development. You need to know the relative magnitude of the various sources of various pollutants in the watershed. You need to understand what the non-point source management control practices are going to do along with the point source controls. So how far will they go in reducing that pollutant down to the appropriate level? And then finally, you need to have a plan within your plan to look ahead to see how you might revise it with your monitoring data. And those are the criteria that Charlie mentioned just a couple of minutes ago. So slide 21. What should watershed plans provide? We think they provide a clear purpose and a roadmap. It's needed to coordinate complex scientific, social, and economic activities. This is going to be important to funders and to the participants in the watershed organization. A plan also provides accountability. What indicators are you going to count? Why are they important to watershed resources? This is going to be important, again, to the funders, to the stakeholders, and to the public in the watersheds. This accountability could be expressed in another way. How many times have you told yourself, I wish I had put that in writing? Well, the watershed plans help do that, and I think people feel like they need to meet their part of the bargain with a watershed plan. And finally, we see a watershed plan as providing a way to integrate partnerships and funding. These are just a few of the programs that might have a role in a watershed plan. And by laying out who's going to do what programs will be involved, and where the funding will come from, it's a way that people can see the connection between programs and the watershed plan. Next slide, slide 22. Our hope is that this handbook will supplement existing guides. We recognize that there are a lot of state, tribal, local and nonprofit guides out there that provide excellent information on how to do TMDLs, on capacity building, on watershed planning. We think that our guide can be used in conjunction with these to fill in the gaps and provide some of the technical tools to answer some of those tougher technical questions. This handbook will provide the assistance in developing the necessary details of a plan. The details are often important. This brings me to my own a personal story. I'm working on renovating my house right now, and a friend of mine is a contractor, but he won't begin knocking out one door, one wall, until I've identified where the transom window, which transom window I'm going to use, what the spindles in the stairway are going to be, where the fireplace is going to be. He knows that if he got into it and worked on an ad hoc basis, that ultimately the plan wouldn't come together efficiently. So finally, we see this plan handbook as a starting point for an updatable document for planning across programs and various levels of governments. We would like watershed organizations to use it, and on our website you'll see that we've asked for people to give us their comments, and we've tentatively set June 30th, 2006 deadline for comments. And then we'd like to integrate those, the experience that people have in using it, into the next version of the plan.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. I hope we're all going to be invited to the housewarming once your house is done. Next, we're going to dive in now to each step and go into greater detail showing you how the handbook can help address some of the most commonly asked questions that we see in watershed planning. So moving on to number 24, if I didn't say 23, you should be on the little stick figures now, 24. First question, how do I know who to involve in my watershed planning effort? Now, what I've seen is many groups are afraid they're going to leave someone out. And so what they do is they don't move forward. They're just kind of paralyzed and stagnate. Who you're going to involve is going to depend on the concerns and issues you have in your watershed, as well as what your goals and objectives are. So if moving to 25, we've provided, this is part of a worksheet we have in the handbook, and it's helpful to work with your stakeholder group to answer some of these questions. So the first one, who's responsible for implementation? Obviously, if they're going to be responsible for implementing the plan, you better make sure they're involved in developing the plan. Similarly, who's going to be affected by the plan? You need to have them at the table, and this is where a lot of people tend not to involve the difficult people up front because they're going to derail the process, and frankly, that's exactly why you need to involve them up at the front, and you can't leave them out because they're going to be difficult, because they're going to be difficult later on. And it's kind of like at your wedding, or my wedding, that if you don't invite your great Aunt Ethel because she's loud and obnoxious and smells, it's going to haunt you forever. Trust me. So bring them to the table first. Even if they don't come to the table, you still need to invite them and give them that opportunity. You also have to realize that you probably will not include everyone at the beginning. You'll leave someone out. But you tell people this is an inclusive process. It's an iterative process. You ask for input from the stakeholders you have. Have we left someone out? Okay. Moving on to slide 26, another question we see a lot. How do I know what other programs I need to coordinate with? There are so many programs out there. And what we have done in the handbook is we have gone from the federal, state, tribal, regional, local level and identified some common programs you may want to think about. And at least you can skim through and consider. Oh, state wetlands program. That's a good idea. Oh, my State Department of Transportation. Why would I want to involve them? And we tell you why you may want to involve them, and we give you links to where you can find more information. Your local extension offices, planning and zoning programs, coastal zone management. There's so many out there. And so we, because this is a national perspective, we have identified several possible programs you may want to involve. This also is going to help you, again, with that sustainability issue. If you can integrate with these programs now and weave your watershed effort into some of these other programs, it's going to enhance the chances of success down the road, both for funding, for technical expertise, and resources. Moving to slide 27, my recommendation is that the key is to start locally first. And this is where you're going to find the most specific information and the partners that are really going to make a difference. Then you can expand, cast your net a little wider, state, tribal issues, and national. And it's really interesting because we saw kind of a printout of the attendees today, and we've got representatives at every level, EPA, Maryland DNR, Taos Pueblo, cities of Rogers, Arkansas, the universities, Associated New Jersey Water Association, Ohio State. It's really great because we kind of have a microcosm of a truly great watershed planning effort. So I hope that kind of sets the stage for step one. Now we're going to move on to, no or not, we're going to take some questions. Sorry. Thank you very much. Ron, back to you.
Thanks, Charlie. As Charlie mentioned, we're ready for our first question and answer period. If you have advanced ahead, you're on slide 28, which confirms that. First, I'd like to ask a question or two that were submitted online. Our first question is from Cindy in Texas, who says, we say that more than just the nine elements must be included in a successful plan. Does the group have any suggestions on how to integrate additional elements into the basic scheme of nine elements? And I'll pose that question to Charlie.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Hi, Cindy. I think basically the only step, truly, that does not include one of the elements, and it's also the nearest and dearest to my heart, is step one, building partnerships. And that's inherent in the watershed planning process. The other elements, if you see in that table we showed, I think it's on slide 15. Actually, you probably shouldn't go back because I don't want everyone to lose track where we are. But the elements are included throughout. So I don't think it's necessarily integrating other elements. It's in making sure your nine elements are included. And again, I think as I mentioned earlier, it's really in the design of your implementation program where we see a lot of these watershed plans fall down, both in terms of calculating, identifying those pollutant loads, and that's where Leslie's going to go next, and then getting very specific. A lot of plans tend to be very vague, and they produce a laundry list of management practices. But the management practices are not tied to really reducing those loads. So I think that's the best way to go about that. Hope I've answered that.
Thanks, Charlie. At this point, I'll open up the phone lines and ask folks that are dialing in if they have any questions. I do, again, ask you to mute your phone if you are not submitting questions. If you could identify your name and where you're calling from, and then your question, please.
So, George, this is about a 300-page document handbook on how to do watershed plans for applicable to our state partners, tribes, down to, you know, nonprofits who want to do plans building on EPA's 9-9. And there's that handbook to help the states and help us. It will be more prescriptive instead of just any. Yeah, so this is the first rollout. There's about probably 160 groups either online called in, like we're calling.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. Is somebody asking a question? And if so, could you pose it a little bit more loudly, please?
When can we get this? Well, I have it on disk. I can, and I do have the copy of the hand.
About the same.
I've been
in a couple of them.
Copies of this
for
you guys.
They can be pretty informative, you know.
I do ask everyone again to mute your phones if you do not have a question for the webcast presenters. Thank you.
Time you kind of go out. There's pieces of it that you probably could sit in on and get the pieces you kind of go
past. Guys from Georgia, please quiet your phone.
The individual from Georgia, please ask a question. Are there any other questions from the phone lines?
I have questions.
Hey. At this stage, I will turn it back over to Charlie, who will introduce our next presenter, Leslie Shoemaker.
Okay. Thanks, Ron. Next, I'd like to introduce Leslie Shoemaker. If we move on to past slide 28 and on to 29, she's going to now cover steps 2 and 3, characterizing the watershed and setting goals and identifying solutions in the watershed. Leslie?
Thank you very much, Charlie. I'm going to go ahead and proceed with talking about watershed characterization and talking about how we actually manage the information and come to some of the analytical, more technical conclusions that drive our watershed plans. So if we turn to slide 29, watershed characterization is really the process of gathering and analyzing data. And I'll be going through some of the steps here identified on the first page and talking about how we manage these various information sources. One of the major challenges associated with watershed management is that we have lots of different kinds of information. And we could spend a large amount of our available time, and maybe more time than we have available, analyzing and sorting and processing information or putting it into data sets. And so one of the things that we've emphasized throughout the manual is steps that you can take to focus your resources and focus your attention on that information that is relevant to your decision making and how to organize that information so that you can reach conclusions. So if we turn over to slide number 30, here are some of the questions that will drive you in part of your information management process. So the first step is really basing it on that understanding of the watershed, basing it on what the stakeholder community tells you, what your information tells you, what you already know about the system, and using that information to help guide what your analytical process is. So that one step is figuring out what kind of information is available, and the other part that you'll be focusing on is figuring out what information is missing. So where is the information that's missing, again, from a targeted point of view? Not that you need to collect all the information that's out there in the watershed, but you need to identify what it is that's missing. All right. Next. Collecting the data. If we start talking about how we're going to collect that information, it is a information management situation where you're trying to get your hands around everything that could be relevant that's out there. And it could be a combination of communications to local governments, to communication to the individual stakeholders, tracking down leads of people that did reports previously or other studies that have been done within the area. And the intent is to gather as much as you can so that you can make informed decisions about what analysis you're going to do. If you move forward to slide number 32, the programs that Charlie talked about earlier, that inventory of what types of programs are driving what's going on within the watershed that may have driven data gathering procedures in the past, or may ones be ones that you're trying to address in the future, will help you decide where the information is and what type of information you need. So if wetlands protection is an ongoing concern within the watershed, then wetland information and wetland mapping will be a critical piece of information within that system. If you move to the next slide, we're also looking at building on what's been done before. So if there are earlier reports that already summarize the condition of a lake or did a study on how to manage a lake and interpreted the data there, you want to identify those reports and identify how they might be used to help you. We have a section that talks about typical other studies that might be available, such as TMDL reports, that could be used as the basis for a watershed plan where you would build upon that. One thing to keep in mind when you're using these earlier reports or earlier data is that things and conditions may have changed over time. You always need to look at when that report data was collected, what the base information is, and what the incremental changes have been over the period of time since that was written and completed. If you turn to slide 34, we have a number of areas where we discuss issues associated with scale, meaning the size of the watershed, and I know many of the agencies and groups that are on the phone today deal with scales as small as a square mile or a few hundred acre watershed, all up to thousands of acres or a rotating basin approach at the state level. So the scale that we're operating on will definitely affect how we collect the information, how we process it, and how we prioritize the analysis and what we're going to do with that information. The more smaller the scale, the more likely we are to really need to do very detailed site-specific evaluations of information, walk the area, look at the streams, because some of our larger, more global data sets won't have the detail that we need in order to support decision-making. All right, let's look next at slide number 35. After the data inventory and after you pull together kind of a watershed initial characterization of what's available within a watershed, the question always comes up about what kind of sampling is needed. How much additional sampling or how much additional data do we really need to collect? And most of us are maybe a little bit ambitious and wishing that we could collect lots and lots of additional information, but most of the time we have financial and time constraints that preclude us doing as much as we would like. There are ways to target some of that information collection associated with specific issues that you might have within the watershed. You could do drive-bys, windshield surveys, targeted site visits, look at volunteer monitoring to supplement information. These are all things that are of relatively low cost. Some of the other techniques like bioassessments or targeted chemical and biological sampling can be used then to fill in areas where there are specific concerns or there is an issue that really warrants looking at data in more detail. If we turn to slide 36, we have a section that really talks about this ongoing learning process that happens when you're doing watershed studies. And one of the things when we try to identify very sequential and deliberate steps as you move up and up this staircase, for instance, we found that one of the reasons why it's hard to really crystallize these steps is because we tend to move back and forth all the time. So you do a data inventory, you identify gaps, you collect some new information, maybe you do some analysis, and then you realize that something else is missing, that you need some other information. And you go back and you collect a little bit more information and you work your way up again. So the watershed process will have a tendency to go forward and backward, up and down these staircases as you continually ask questions, answer them, get information, and process information. So if you would turn to the next slide, which is number 37, let's talk a little bit about some of the data analysis techniques. And data analysis is clearly a huge complex process in many ways. We included, it's one of the larger chapters in the handbook, we've included many examples, statistics, graphs, and other experiences of how we might process data in order to gather information from it or glean information from it. When you're looking at the characterization process, again, this is one where your resources and your time need to be targeted to things that are most likely to provide you information that will help you make decisions. And what I'll go through here is just four quick examples of some of the data analysis techniques that are in the handbook, and I'd encourage you to look at those for more details on each of these methodologies and which ones are most appropriate under various conditions. So if you turn to slide 38, here's an example of the kind of analysis you might do in one particular location. So one location where you're doing monitoring over a long period of time. In this case, we're looking at a 6-year period where there's been monitoring going on. And we might ask the question, does it meet water quality standards? The red line is the acute criteria. This is a measure of water quality condition in a stream. And the blue dots that are above the red line would be the ones where the observations violated the acute criteria. So this might answer a question of what condition is this water in and how bad is it? How bad is it relative to a measure of water quality? If we move to the next slide, number 39, this asks the same type of question, which is what is the condition of a water based on the sample? In this case, it's total dissolved solids. But what is the condition of a water body? But let's look at it spatially. Let's look at it across the whole watershed and where are the hot spots, so to speak. So the larger red dots are the ones where the concentration is higher, and the smallest dots in the green are the ones where the concentration is the lowest. This gives us a different kind of snapshot of the watershed. It shows us a spatial distribution of what's happening. All right. If you go to the slide number 40, here's yet another way to look at the data. This is looking at it in terms of a low duration curve, where we're looking at the percent of time where different flows occur. So the highest flow events would be on the far right-hand side, and the lowest flow conditions would be on the left-hand side. and all of our loading data and monitoring data is sorted according to these flow percentiles. And the interpretation of these types of graphs would be, we could see that the observed data in the yellow, how it matches up to the allowable loading under different flow conditions. The far left would show us dominantly point source types of inputs, and the data on the far right would be dominantly non-point source related inputs. And so this is one way to start sorting out what types of sources are contributing under different flow conditions, under wet weather, under dry weather, or a combination. And finally, if you move to slide number 41, there's one other dimension that we look at when we look at water quality data. We also have to look at what changes over time. So when you're looking at monitoring data over a long period of time, you might see a signal. This is kind of like a diagnosis of that a doctor might use. You're diagnosing the stream, and you're saying, well, looks like before July 97, there was a certain condition, and after July 97, going into 98 and through 2002, there was distinctly higher loading conditions on the downstream side and the downstream monitoring stations. The kind of pale purple points that are all a downstream station versus an upstream one. And so the conclusion drawn from this kind of graph was that there was a new source that was introduced somewhere after July of 97 that changed the conditions in the watershed. And that's a diagnostic tool that, again, would be maybe that's a source that needs to be remediated, but it also needs to be understood how something changed over time. All right, if you move to slide number 42, let's talk about a little bit about how we can estimate the loads. So far, we were looking at diagnosing and interpreting and analyzing data based on monitoring only and based on other information like land use. Now when we look at diagnosing the sources that are contributing within a watershed, the forested areas, the agricultural areas, the urban and the developing areas, we need to use some other techniques. And we talk about three kinds of techniques that could be used to generate load estimates. The first type is direct interpretation of monitoring data. There's some statistical techniques that you can use to do that. We talk about mass balance approaches, which generally add up what's in the stream and allow you to come up with sort of a gross loading estimate for different locations. And then finally, we talk about the various models and tools that are out there of various levels of complexity that can help us come up with those loading estimates. So let's, if you move forward to slide 43, one of the questions is, why might I even want to do a model of the system? It's not necessary in all cases. Many times our watershed plans, we want to do something very action-oriented. We want to do our inventory and move straight forward into more implementation and some simplified calculations. Other times we might need to do some more detailed analysis just to be able to fully diagnose what the problems are and what the solution, best possible solution might be. So one of the things models can tell us is what's the loading, how is the loading coming into the system over time, maybe what the concentration is within the stream, all things that might relate to the aquatic habitat or the water quality conditions. So let's go to slide number 44. This is kind of our conceptual graphic that's used to organize the model selection discussion. And this is when you're shopping. We're shopping for models and we're shopping for a solution. There's four major factors that we're going to look at. We're going to look at whether that model can simulate the pollutants that we're concerned about. If we're concerned about pathogens, then we need models. If we're going to do modeling, we need a model that can simulate pathogen behavior or pathogen loading and die-off. If our metals are the biggest concern, we need to make sure that we have a reasonable way to approximate the loading of metals within the system. So the pollutant selection is one of the key selection criteria in picking models. Three other factors that are there are what are the dominant land use categories. Many models are dominantly used for agriculture or urban land uses, so it's important to understand what your watershed characteristics are. We also want to know what geographic scale we're operating at, how detailed we want to be, and finally we need to know the time scale. If this is something that is a short-term wet weather violation or a problem with wet weather loadings, or if it's something that's associated with long-term loading characteristics, the time frame will also be a factor to consider. Slide 45 just illustrates again how watershed models really are a combination of different types of information. All that data that you pull during the characterization phase, most modest watershed models include a variety of information that is used to come up with a combined estimate, land use, management practices, it might be stream characteristics, and those information that ultimately results in generating our pollutant loading information. One of the things, if we go to slide 46, we can talk a little bit about how we can look at sediment loading by simulating or doing watershed modeling by sub-watershed. Again, this relates to that spatial interpretation over space, over the landscape of a watershed. Where are the areas where the loading is coming from? This kind of information can help us target resources. It can help us prioritize the areas that we might want to do more field reconnaissance, and ultimately can help us decide where to site individual practices and BMPs that we might want to use. If you turn to slide 47, in this case, we've just included sort of seven of the most commonly used models in watershed management. These are for the watershed loading purposes. All of these models have fact sheets and other information included within the handbook. These are the models that come up frequently in looking at both in agricultural and urban areas. The STEPL model is one that's been developed for simplified calculations and is available via the web. It's an Excel spreadsheet that includes a simple BMP calculator technique. AGNIPS, GWLF, P8 all provide a reasonably simplified way of dealing with looking at nutrient loading and sediment loading and runoff. And the SWAT, SWIM, and HSPF model provide more detailed and comprehensive approaches for looking at many of these things. So these are some of the models that are out there. These are all in the public domain and are publicly available models. The learning curve for applying them is steeper as you go to the more complex models on the bottom. If you go to the next slide, number 48, this is just one example of some of the dot tables or comparative tables that are provided within the modeling section. One of the things I mentioned was that we are one of the first criteria for selecting models is what pollutants it simulates. This graph that relates endpoints to models really is relating parameters that we're concerned, might be concerned within a watershed or in a river to the types of models that would allow you to simulate them. And there are various levels of sophistication. All right, let's talk a little bit now on step three about identifying goals and identifying, finalizing your goals and solutions. So we've talked about getting data, we've talked about analyzing data, now we have to figure out how we're going to link the goal to the solution. And there are a couple ways we can do it. Let's talk about setting in slide 50. There are big picture goals. These are set more in the stakeholder process and in the information gathering process at the beginning. These are narrative statements of desirable conditions. They translate into specific objectives. That might be something that you're going to do that will result in a specific action or a specific benefit. And if we go to slide 51, this is the part that we're really going to focus on now is we want numbers. We want to identify measurable parameters that link the sources to a specific condition. So what is the number that we'll use to evaluate whether the watershed is improving, and what is the number that we're going to use to evaluate how we're going to get there? If you go to slide 52, this conceptually just links these various steps into a process. So you have goals, you have indicators, you have objectives, and ultimately these targets that will help you set the loads and identify where you're going and measure your progress to achieving those results. Slide 53, just one sort of reminder, when we're looking at identifying goals and targets, we also need to know where we're going to do management actions. We also need to know where we're going to measure the results. And so most watershed plans will include both targeting of where the actions are as well as targeting of where the what we would call assessment points or measurement points are within the stream system. Slide 54 talks about comparative analysis that you could do if you were doing a reference watershed approach. So one of the ways that we've used to set targets in the absence of other measures or in cases where there are no specific criteria or numbers to measure is to compare two watersheds or two streams to each other. Watershed B, for instance, being a relatively unimpacted stream that's in good condition. Watershed A is one that might have some impairment, and we use the watershed B to set the benchmark of where we'd like to be, of where we'd like to be in terms of in-stream water quality. Number 55, identifying management targets. Part of defining how you're going to restore a watershed is defining what load reduction or what change you're going to make in order to meet those restoration targets. So coming up with a numeric estimate of the reductions that are required from each of the source types or by watershed or by sub-watershed will help you define where you're going, the load reduction you need, and then ultimately how you're going to achieve it. Slide 56, there are a number of different scenarios that you might be able to do. This is just an example of a watershed where there's a mixed land use, there's a phosphorus load, and here's two different examples of how that loading might be reduced from the various sources in order to achieve that load. Scenario one is an equal reduction from all sources. Scenario two is a targeted reduction from selected sources. In practice, normally there's some targeting going on to those sources that are the ones where you're most likely to be able to put BMPs in that will be result in significant reductions. For instance, you might target some of the disturbed land areas more than areas like forests where there's more difficult to get load reductions. Slide number 57, just an example again of targeting. In this case, this watershed has a distribution of buffer streams in this conceptual load reduction scenario. In slide 58, I'd like to just briefly talk a little bit about BMPs and their effectiveness and how we sort of focus in on those BMPs that are most likely to achieve our overall objectives and goals. We can identify an inventory of possible management practices. And in fact, our handbook has a significant number of all the practices that are out there in various source types and various categories that could be used, to achieve the management goals that have been identified. However, when you look at a specific watershed, not all practices are applicable in every watershed within the country. There are specific practices that are more applicable to certain regional areas in cold weather, in warm weather, or in certain soil types, or in certain land use conditions. There are some areas where infiltration, for instance, is very poor, and so practices that rely heavily upon infiltration as their way of dealing with water quality are no longer going to be appropriate in those areas. And so we identify and recommend going through a screening process to identify those candidate management practices that are the most likely to succeed within the areas of your watershed and your management planning process. If you move to slide 59, selecting the most appropriate BMPs, beyond going through this candidate selection process, there are sort of a checklist of other things that you can do to make sure that the BMPs are appropriate for the watershed that you're looking at, and also to start actually siting or targeting specific locations where those BMPs could be installed. So the track record of what's worked within the current watershed, information that's released on the effectiveness that's out there on the BMP types, the cost-related opportunities, property ownership and access to sites, availability of sites is a key factor in inventorying and citing available BMPs. And in many cases, there is an opportunity to use combinations of practices within certain areas that have a cumulative benefit of more than just an individual BMPs. The increased emphasis on targeting and using critical areas to identify where the BMPs might go is also a factor to consider. So these are all ways that we can improve our effectiveness and improve how we site BMPs in a specific location. Slide 60 just shows another example, and there's some others that are in within the text, you can go through a very systematic process of identifying the BMPs and then ranking and prioritizing the ones that are the most appropriate for a region or a specific location. And so they could be ranked. In this case, there's an example showing how it would be ranked based on the pollutant reduction potential, the cost, the benefit, the likelihood of the public to accept it, the maintenance cost, and come up with a total score that then tells you which ones are the most likely to succeed for a particular location. So it's just an example of a ranking process, and this could also be done as an interactive process or a collective process with your stakeholder group. And now let's talk a little bit more, just for a couple minutes, about the references for determining BMP effectiveness. BMPs, best management practices that are used predominantly in non-point source areas or urban stormwater areas, have a wide range of effectiveness numbers. Effectiveness is normally measured by monitoring before and after the installation or upstream and downstream of the installation of a specific management practice. There have been a number of efforts to compile available literature and available monitoring data on BMP effectiveness, and I'll go through a list of those that are available. There are also various models and tools that incorporate this information or do even more detailed simulation of BMP performance and effectiveness. So four of the major data sources that are commonly used for some of the BMP data as part of planning purposes are the BMP Effectiveness Database, and I'll show some screen grabs of these, the Management Measure Guidance in Agricultural and Forestry and Urban Areas, and also a document on mining. All of these references and links are provided in the manual. If you go to slide 62, here's an example of the web screen for the National Management Measures Guidance. This is the agricultural screen, and shows the availability of the guidance as well as the update of information that's available on the various BMP types and their effectiveness information. Slide 63 shows you an example of a table. Here's just a classic example of a practice where it talks about what's reduced, it talks about the percentage removals, and the references associated with those. Remember, many of these effectiveness practices can vary regionally, can vary locally. If you have local data available on your individual BMP, obviously, you're encouraged to use those first. If you don't have locally available data, you may want to look at supplementing by using these various sources. On slide 64, one of the national comprehensive databases that's been generated is the Urban Stormwater BMP Performance Monitoring, as in collaboration between EPA and American Society of Civil Engineers. This data also provides a comprehensive inventory of the types of monitoring and BMP effectiveness that's been documented in the literature that's out there. Slide 65 shows another sample of a BMP effectiveness table, again documented in this case as percent efficiency, and these are load reductions for nutrients and phosphorus and fecal coliforms. Slide 66 talks a little bit about the removal effectiveness that we might get from various types of ponds for different BMP types. And so one of the things that we do when we inventory various BMP types is we look at where the BMPs are, we look at the drainage area served by those various practices, and then we look at the percent reductions or other measures of the impact of those BMPs either at the site or downstream from the site. Remember, these are cumulative numbers, so we need to be able to add up not just the effectiveness of a particular practice locally over a long period of time, but also what the cumulative benefit of installing practices over the landscape of an entire watershed are and what the downstream benefit and loading reductions might be associated with that. And so we're always looking at how can we treat that watershed and what number of acres are being treated for each of those watersheds. Many of these can be done using spreadsheet tools, and as well as some of the other modeling and analytical tools that are included within the analysis. And with that, I will turn it back to the moderator for our question session.
Great. Thanks, Leslie. As we did with the previous question and answer period, we'll ask some questions that have been submitted online first and then open up the phones for additional questions. Again, I do ask that those participating via phone make sure that you have muted your phone lines unless you do have a specific question. We'll start with Charlie. There are a couple questions submitted for her presentation. The first comes from Karen in Oklahoma. And Karen asks, will this document be taking the place of other EPA watershed outreach documents?
Okay, thank you, Ron. Thank you, Karen, for the question. No, absolutely not. And one of how we structured the handbook is that it's really not supposed to take the place of any documents, but rather supplement. And so EPA's watershed outreach documents, the Getting in Step documents, still very much are applicable and should be used. We don't go into a lot of detail in the handbook on the outreach. I also, there were several other questions kind of related to that in terms of how do you get individuals involved and the watershed planning process, and also how do you get agencies involved when it's not a life or death situation. And that's where I would refer you to the outreach guide, where there's a lot of social marketing and talks about behavior change and how you can sort of reach the needs of your customers.
Thanks, Charlie. Stay on the line because the next question is also for you. This one comes from Robert in Ohio, who says that sustainable watershed groups are often underserved regarding public relations, long-term funding, and board development. Are there any resources referenced available for these shortcomings?
Okay, yes. Thank you, Robert, for the call. In the resource section of the guide, we do include lots of references, both in terms of watershed organization development, forming the watersheds, like you're talking about, the board development, grassroots fundraising, and again, we provide the resources and the URLs of where you can get that information. Good question.
Thanks, Charlie. Now I'll turn it over to Stuart, who has been barraged with a number of questions. The first comes from Anne, also of Ohio, who says, what do you think of the idea for incremental implementation? My thinking for this suggestion is that it is often difficult to get commitments for expensive actions, either in terms of time or money, but you may be able to get commitments for smaller initial actions. Stuart?
Thanks for the question, Ann. Clearly, watershed organizations can take steps to improve water quality and protect water resources before a plan has been completed. There are certain small steps that can be funded. They may be funded through other grant programs. Many states have small grants just for doing that. In terms of 319 money, we would like to see the plan in place for watershed projects before they're funded. And this is a case where annual work plans and applications for funding that would come in every year, maybe every other year, where they can be used to incrementally fund the project.
Thanks, Stuart. Stay on the line because there's another question for you. This one comes from Chuck in Texas, who says that many funding sources are based on 1 to 3 year cycles. Do you have any data on existing projects that can shed light on how long the 6 steps for implementation are taking? A conceptual timeline for each step would be helpful.
Thank you, Chuck. From my experience, I found that it's often perhaps 1 or 2 years before a brand new watershed organization can actually get sufficiently organized to begin restoration. The planning itself could take up to a year, sometimes more. This will often depend upon the scope of the problems and size of the watersheds. So I think it really depends on how much work has already been done in forming the group and getting together their priorities.
Thanks, and one more for Stuart. This one comes from Michelle in Georgia, who says, I assume that many state, local, and federal agencies are reviewing plans for compliance with EPA's 9 key elements or for internal requirements. Is there an evaluation tool to evaluate these plans? And if so, can it be made available?
Okay, good question. I think the first stop is to check with the states within your region to see what sources of information they might use or what kind of checklist they might use in reviewing plans. Often the state will have its own planning framework. We have, at EPA, kept the elements relatively short, and we expect the regions to work with their states in evaluating how well the plan elements are addressed.
Thanks, Stu. And now we have some questions that appear to be directed toward Leslie. The first comes from William in New York, who asks, regarding slide number 47, is EPA's WASP, W-A-S-P model omitted purposely from that list?
Okay, thank you. There are two major locations where modeling is discussed. The section that I was referring to in slide number 47 is the watershed loading portion of the modeling, and WASP is a receiving water model, so it's really targeted. The models that are selected there are targeted towards loading. In Chapter 9, if you refer to the table in Chapter 9, I think it's page 9-12, there are a list of receiving water models that are used to look at achieving in-stream targets or in-stream goals. WASP is included within that area, as well as a number of other models which can model in-stream conditions.
Thanks, Leslie. And we'll do one more question that was submitted online before opening up the phones. And this one comes from Jason in New Hampshire, who asks, is there specific guidance when developing numeric load reduction targets? How much is enough?
Identifying a load reduction target actually links right back to the previous question, in that load reduction targets are intended to meet an in-stream condition or a desirable condition that's defined as part of the goal-setting process. And then we look at how we can reduce that load sufficiently to meet that in-stream target. The level of specificity and how you do that depends somewhat on how you what the purpose of the watershed plan is. So if you're doing a watershed plan for the purposes of generating a TMDL, for instance, there are some more specific guidelines of what might need to be achieved. If you're doing it for the purposes of meeting the 9 minimum elements for 319, there are some guidelines in there of what's expected. And in many cases, we might do watershed plans as more of a general restoration exercise, and there might be a little bit more flexibility as how we define those specific load reduction targets. But we have identified the general steps that take you through that process.
Great. Thanks, Leslie. At this time, I'll open up the phone lines to questions and, again, ask everyone, if you do not have a question, to please mute your phone lines. If you do have a question, please introduce your name and where you're from, and we'll acknowledge you and allow you to ask your question. I'm now opening phone lines. Any questions?
Oh, you got a question?
No.
Steve Smith in Idaho.
Okay, Steve Smith in Idaho, go ahead.
On the model,
but now they're available now, you can go online.
Model, how much data is required for those, and where do you get some of those models?
That's a local watershed guy, I'd say.
Thanks for the question. In the handbook, we identify the links so that for getting each of those models. All of them are available either online as a download. Most of them are readily available since they're all public domain models at no cost. The amount of data is going to vary depending on the model that's selected. So depending on the individual model that you pick, the lowest end ones mostly will require information like land use and some limited monitoring data so that you can make an initial assumption. The higher end ones might require knowing a lot more details about the stream channel characteristics and the slopes and the topography. So I'd advise you to look at some of the data fields in there that relate to each of the models, as well as the model handbook.
Probably not even enough
terminology in there. Great. Any other questions from the hinterlands?
And you got a good chiropractor already, right?
Oh, yeah, but they want me to get away.
Other questions besides chiropractic talk?
No.
They want it to be stable.
Okay. I'm now going to mute the lines again and send it back to Charlie, who will introduce our next speaker.
Now I'm going to introduce Barry Conning, who's going to bring us home. And he's going to lead us through the remaining steps, 4, 5, and 6, where we lay out how we're going to implement this plan, how we're going to measure progress, and how we're going to make changes as needed. Barry?
All right. Thank you, Charlie. You should be on slide number 68 now, looking at Rosie the Riveter. I know everybody's probably real anxious to get out there and start collecting data right now and identifying your endpoints and targets and so forth, but hopefully you can bear with us for about 40 more minutes while we finish up here. And for those of you who are maybe a little intimidated by watershed planning, take some comfort in the fact that a lot of what is in watershed planning is some of the things that you've already been doing over time. And if we can put a man on the moon, we can certainly develop and implement watershed plans. So we'll start out on page 68 and cover the last three steps of watershed, the overall process, designing an implementation program, implementing the plan, and then measuring progress and making adjustments. On slide 69, you see one of the slides that you saw earlier that has all of the various steps and sub-steps in the watershed management process. And you'll see that with the red check marks there, we're on the last three major steps. You also see there the white shaded areas that indicate where EPA's nine elements are for watershed plans. And you see that a lot of them are found in this step we're going to cover next, step four. And once we get done with step four, you will have your watershed plan documented. You can see out there on the right that at the end of step four results in the development of the plan itself, and then step five is implementation. Step six deals with measuring progress and making adjustments.
We're going to switch to using the phone. We hopefully will have better reception here. So hold on 1 second here.
Okay. I'm on the phone now. Hopefully this is better. Step four, designing the implementation program. We're on slide number 70 now, and these are some of the sub-steps that will occur during this process. And you see at the very bottom there, as I mentioned, documentation of these tasks will complete the plan itself, and then the following two steps will deal with implementation and adaptation. We'll talk a little bit about these, the implementation schedule. You've already looked at some of the things that you need to do in the watershed. Developing the schedule will give you an idea of when these things will be done. Milestones will be set to try to give you some idea of when you're reaching some of your interim targets, how you'll measure success. Leslie talked earlier about some of the indicators and so forth that you'll use that will hopefully give you some idea on how fast or how much you're moving towards your endpoints. Developing the monitoring component, we'll talk a little bit about that in the evaluation process overall, and also identifying technical and financial assistance and resources that you'll need. And finally, you know, who's going to be doing all these things? We'll talk a little bit about these over the next 20 or 30 minutes. To start out with, your implementation plan needs to be based on some of the things that you already know about your watershed and hopefully some of the things that have already been tried, if not in your watershed, elsewhere. And here are some of the questions that you might ask before you launch off on implementing management practices in your area. Who can help implement BMPs or controls? And there are a lot of options out there. As time has gone on over the last 20 years, there have been a lot more organizations and entities that have been involved in developing BMPs, adapting them for local conditions, and actually implementing them. How can they be implemented? And again, looking at what's been done in the past in your watershed is always a big help. And elsewhere in your type of area, whether it's an agricultural region or an urban environment, and looking at some of the results from that, how well did it work? As Leslie mentioned, BMPs don't necessarily fit everywhere that they might be needed. In some areas, they may need to be adapted before they can be implemented. And Leslie mentioned the infiltration-type BMPs might not work very well in areas of heavy clay. So it's important to get an idea of whether the BMPs are appropriate for your area before you start implementation. When can we get started? And there will be some short-term things that can be done, and then, of course, you'll have your long-term goals, whether the goals deal with meeting water quality criteria for whatever use is designated for that water body, or whether there are other types of endpoints, maybe aesthetical concerns or protection of a drinking water source. And then finally, how do we know if it's working, and what are we going to do if it's not working, the adaptive management phase. On slide 72, we've got just a quick summary of the six steps of outreach and education. Charlie mentioned earlier that this is one of the more important processes in watershed management. Outreach and education is very much an orderly process. The first thing that you really need to do is identify what you want for your goal, or what objective are you trying to achieve with your outreach or education activity. So what are you going to do? Who are you going to do it with? Who's the target audience? What are they all about? Where do they get their information from? What are their opinions? What rings their bell? What gets their attention, and so forth? Once you have your objective and your audience identified, you can figure out what kind of a message is going to resonate with that audience and package that message for distribution, get it out there to your audience, and then see whether or not you've achieved some success. And there are a lot of examples on outreach and education. On the EPA Nonpoint Source website, there is a toolkit and a couple of publications on outreach and education that are important for any type of effort, whether it's trying to build support for ordinances, trying to interest people in volunteer monitoring, trying to get people to contribute to a cleanup, or trying to get people to sign up for BMP implementation. On slide 73, prioritizing your management efforts, it's been pointed out several times that you're not going to be able to do everything at once. You really do need to look at what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck, and in some cases, not that, but just what's achievable in the short run. So integrating some of your assessment results across objectives, and what we mean here, you may have objectives that deal with habitat improvement. You may have objectives that deal with aesthetics, maybe a cleanup type project. Looking at some of those things and seeing what types of activities may hit several different objectives is recommended, and there are some factors to consider down here. What are the biggest threats? Maybe there are some regulatory requirements that need to be met, particularly for drinking water sources. Where are existing management regulations and so forth falling short? Maybe there's just some tweaking that needs to be done in education of the regulated community, or compliance assistance, training, and so forth. And then finally, what stakeholders want. And the stakeholder preferences listed lasted there, but it's extremely important. A lot of times when you'll get into a watershed project, you'll have ideas that you would like to achieve for this water body, and you get a group of people together, and their ideas may be completely different. An example of that is a project I was familiar with a few years ago when there were some water quality objectives that were very important for some of the group that started this process off. And when they got some of the citizens in the room, they wanted the creek cleaned up. They wanted to have a walking path along the creek and a gazebo and a lot of other things that really didn't deal with water quality. But by paying attention to their concerns first and dealing with them, it was a lot easier to get them interested in some of the other issues. Oh, yeah, you know, we're walking along this creek, but the water quality isn't that great. There's some other things we need to do. So stakeholder preferences can play a really big part in this. Moving to the next slide, setting times and targets on slide 74, talks about your implementation schedule. And again, you will have some things that you'll identify that you might be able to do over the next 6 months or year or 2 years, and other things that may need to be extended on out into the future. It's taken many years for our watersheds to get into the condition that they're in now, and it's highly unlikely that we're going to make everything right in the next 2 or 3 years. So the plan is not an effort to try to force everything and speed everything up and have everything done in the next 18 months. The plan is intended to be a realistic roadmap for how things might be done over a number of years. In the short term, hopefully there will be a lot more specificity and assignment of responsibilities and dollar amounts and BMP locations and menus and so forth. Moving on out from that over the longer term, 5 and 10 years down the road, you may not really know. You may need to get some information on how implementation goes during the first year or two or three before you can be real specific about the long term. But it is important to try to put something down there in terms of where you think you might need to be and what you think might need to be done, because that's going to inform people who may come to the process later on. And that is really one of the more valuable things about the plan. It does provide a roadmap for what you're going to be doing over the long term, but also it provides a guide for people who may come after you. If you do have staff turnover, you have a new person in the position, or maybe a group of new people in a few years, if you have a plan that lays things out as best you can, they'll have some idea of what you looked at, why you made the decisions that you made, and where this process needs to move toward. And they can sort of walk into the job and pick up where you left off very easily. If these things aren't documented, it's very difficult to do that. And I say there are probably a couple of people out there who know what I'm talking about. How will you measure success? Leslie again talked about some of the parameters that you might be trying to impact with your management practices. What indicators are linked to those parameters? Are you trying to deal with sediment problems? Are you trying to deal with habitat where you may need to look at stream bank stability and vegetation and so forth? So trying to link the indicators that you're going to measure with the problems that you're trying to solve is what you're trying to do here, and then set your milestones. How are you going to show progress? These milestones, in the long term, will hopefully be based on water quality indicators, but in the short term, they may be based on other types of indicators. In doing this, it helps to start out from the big picture. You'll have some sort of broad goals that you're trying to achieve for your water body. We're on slide number 75. You may be trying to protect a drinking water reservoir. You may be trying to restore habitat. So you've got some big picture objectives that you're trying to achieve. And from that, you will develop other sub-objectives, short-term goals, and so forth. And the idea here is to try to develop some indicators to show you whether or not you're moving towards achieving those goals. So you'll look at your indicators, what you're going to measure, your target, what you'd like your measurement to be, and move on into your implementation phase. On slide 77, we've got some examples of indicators. Of course, as I mentioned, the environmental indicators are what we're really trying to impact. Those are the indicators that we really want to see improvement in. Things like algal blooms, how many miles of stream bank have been restored, improvements in dissolved oxygen, and so forth. Those indicators will probably not show a lot of movement early on in your implementation process. Maybe during the first 1 or 2 or even 5 or 6 years, you may not see a lot of movement in the water quality indicators that you're measuring. So during the interim, you may need to find other suites of indicators that you can use to show that your management program is indeed making some progress toward achieving its goals. We've got some examples here of administrative or programmatic indicators. I think most people are pretty familiar with these. A lot of times we do a lot of things and it doesn't really get captured. It is never documented. And so it's kind of lost in the overall evaluation process. So it is important to document some of these things as you go on. Beyond programmatic indicators, you'll see on slide number 78, there are indicators such as social indicators. And again, these are all surrogate indicators. We're not seeing an immediate movement in water quality, so we're measuring other things. And there are just a huge variety of things you can look at here. Everything from pre- and post-surveys on people's awareness and knowledge of watershed issues to things like how many households have had their septic systems pumped or inspected, how many people are calling into an illegal dumping hotline that you've advertised, and so forth. On slide number 79, finalizing the watershed plan, there will be some type of monitoring component that will be tracking some of the indicators that you selected. There'll be an evaluation process of some sort to see whether or not your monitoring results are moving you towards your goal or whether some adjustments need to be made. Whatever management practices that your plan recommends will probably require some type of technical or financial resources, again, short-term and long-term. The short term will hopefully be more specific. The long term may be less so. There's nothing wrong with saying over the long term we would like to do X practices in this area and we're going to seek funding from these sources. Maybe the commitments haven't been made yet. It's certainly recommended to try to identify potential funding sources if you don't have anything nailed down yet. And then finally, assigning responsibility for action. We'll talk a little bit about some of these. On the next slide, slide 80, you see an example of a table. This is a worksheet that is in the appendix of the Watershed Handbook. And you can see some of the indicators listed there. Targets, what we'd like for our indicator to measure or what progress we'd like to achieve over time. And then you see some interim targets there over the short term, medium term, and long term. So just an example, there are a number of worksheets in the handbook for various steps and sub-steps of the watershed management process that are really helpful in summarizing some of the activities that you're going to be involved in. Slide 81, again, some example milestones, short term, midterm, and long term. On slide number 82, another worksheet from the handbook. At some point, you are going to want to get her done, as they say. And here is a worksheet here that lays out summary information on several tasks for your watershed, who a responsible party might be. And again, sometimes you'll see tentative in parentheses after the name of an organization. There's nothing wrong with that. The idea is to get you thinking about what needs to be done, who needs to do it, what the cost might be. Of course, a lot of these will be estimates, where funding might be coming from, what indicators you may use, and then your milestones. So, again, these are worksheets that are in the handbook and very helpful when it comes time to put all this down on paper. Identifying sources of support. This is an area that is extremely difficult in some places because there's not necessarily a lot of funding for watershed projects, but people have been very creative in finding in-kind services and technical assistance, cost-share money from sources, whether they're private firms or educational institutions and so forth. So this, again, is an area where watershed groups have been extremely creative. I know that there are a lot of watershed groups that lack funding for doing water quality monitoring, and they have involved college classes in collecting data. There are a lot of universities that have an environmental testing methods class. I know when I was at Morehead State University in Kentucky, we incorporated some of the monitoring that we did into some of the projects that the health department was involved in. So that is a huge untapped resource out there. A lot of these classes are collecting data, and it just goes into a student report and is never really incorporated or planned to be incorporated into any type of a project. So a good source. On slide 84, you'll see some examples of financial resources. Several websites are posted here. Everything from the EPA's catalog of federal funding sources down to the Plan to Fund site at Boise State University out in Idaho. So browsing around some of these sites, not only do you see some potential funding sources, but you can also read through projects on some of these sites and get some ideas for some of the things that you might do with your project. Slide 85, the watershed plan is done. And now it's time to spring into action, as they do in North Las Vegas with their pet waste cleanup program. 86, step 5, implementing your watershed plan. We'll talk about the management strategies, monitoring, and some of your outreach activities. Again, outreach and involvement are going to be probably incorporated into most of the steps in your overall watershed management program. It's sort of like Henny Penny here on slide number 87. Who's going to help me bake the bread, grow the wheat, and so forth? Who's going to implement the plan? And again, there are a lot of options here. We have seen watershed projects and plans implemented by organizations as varied as cities and counties to private entities. I know out west there are producer councils and other private organizations that have become very involved in assembling different constituencies and developing a management program and implementing it. Some of these are very focused, some are very broad. But any well-organized single or multiple entity approach can work. So again, look at who you've got around your area, who wants to help, who has resources to help, who can help, and try to get them involved in the implementation. It's not necessary to develop a nonprofit watershed group for a specific situation and so forth. If you have organizations out there with the technical, financial, and managerial capability to do this, I would strongly recommend seeing if they might be interested in helping you take this on. Slide number 88, as you start to implement, you will start to get a little bit of information back on whether or not your management practices are achieving their intended results. Here's a little feedback loop diagram here showing you that hopefully you will be aware that things will be happening on the ground that may influence your decision on whether or not you want to install more of these practices or whether they need to be adapted or whether they're not working at all and you need to go somewhere else. On slide number 89, coordinate with other water resource and land use programs. Of course, this is very commonsensical, but as Will Rogers said, common sense ain't so common, so we put it in here anyway. There are a lot of different programs going on related to the Clean Water Act and other federal and state legislation, local ordinances, and so forth. And again, it is really good to sort of keep your radar tuned into what's going on in the watershed when it comes time to implement your program. I know I've heard from a number of groups that the 1996 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act that deal with requirements for developing source water assessment and protection plans have been a real help to watershed groups that are focused on a surface water that also serves as a drinking water source. So if you're in an area like that, you may want to talk to your water utility and see what kind of assessment they've been doing and partner up. Another great source for watershed work has been the rollout of the Phase 1 and Phase 2 stormwater program. The stormwater Phase 2 program kicked in March of 96, and there are a lot of watershed groups that have all of a sudden found local public works directors very interested in illicit discharge detection and elimination, water quality in urban areas and so forth, and there are great examples of how Phase 2 has dealt with water quality problems throughout. I know in Cleveland, there is a very intensive program to identify possible illicit discharges from on-site systems into the MS4, the local system of ditches and culverts and so forth that make up the stormwater collection system. So a lot of great examples out there. Water quality improvements, again, are the goal. We're on slide number 90 now. So as you do your monitoring, whether you're monitoring water quality or other types of indicators, programmatic indicators, surrogate indicators like social indicators or awareness surveys and so forth, look out there before you get started and see if anyone else is collecting that type of information. Again, graduate students are a great resource. They really need things to be on their resume when they get out of school. They're all going to be out there looking for a job, hopefully. And having a real project and some references from an agency or a watershed organization is really good for graduate students. So if you're looking at water quality monitoring, they're a great resource. There are also journalism schools that do pre- and post-surveys, phone survey work, and so forth. And, again, if you can plug them into your project, you're making use of something that's already going on anyway out there, and it gives them something to put on their resume. On slide number 91, implementing your monitoring program. If you are going to develop a monitoring program and go out and collect data yourself, there are a number of issues to consider there. Those of you who have the resources to do this need to be aware of some of these things. This is discussed in the handbook. Things like staffing, training, and so forth, data management. You may need to have a quality assurance program for your monitoring effort if it's going to be funded by certain sources and so forth. On slide number 92, we have an example of some goals for a water quality monitoring program. This is in the Roaring Fork Watershed in Colorado. Again, just an example to show you that a lot of these things that you're doing need to be captured and need to be recorded because you may not always be there. Someone may come after you and wonder, you know, why are we monitoring here? why are we collecting information on these parameters? Why are we using this type of test instead of something else? So it is important to document not only what you're doing and where you're doing it and how you're doing it, but why you're doing it, just so people know who come after you. Sampling protocols, again, part of a monitoring program if you've got to develop something yourself. Again, your QAP, your Quality Assurance Project Plan, will be a requirement if your monitoring program is funded by certain sources. They will require that. We have had a few questions today on how the 319 program requirements interrelate to this overall watershed planning and management program. On slide number 94, and again on slide number 96, you'll see a table that has some broad watershed parameters and plan elements and so forth, and then you'll see on the side, on the right-hand side, 319 work plan. What we're trying to portray here is that your watershed management plan will be broad. It will incorporate point sources and non-point sources, and it will deal with a number of impairments and threats to the resource. It may have a section in there on protection for some parts of the resource that may be threatened. That watershed management plan will provide a guide for developing 319 work plans if you are going to be using your watershed plan to develop work plans under the non-point source program. So, in essence, your 319 work plans that you submit for funding to your state agency will be extracted from your watershed management plan. Slide number 95, an example of how some of this indicator data can be reported. And once again, I do want to stress the importance of keeping the public and your stakeholders and other interested parties involved and aware of what you're doing. You know, people ride around and they see a truck from the city or the county or the state parked on the side of the road, and people carrying buckets with wires hanging out of them and walking down to the creek, and they like to know what's going on. So if you can report that data either in the media or through some other venue, civic clubs, talks, and so forth, it's always a great idea. Here's an example from the East Fork of the Little Miami River in Ohio on how they report some of their data. They have sort of a color-coded indicator map with various parameters dealing with habitat, water quality parameters, and so forth. The Tennessee Valley Authority used to produce a number of publications for some of the watersheds in their management area with the same type of thing. Whether it's color-coded or sort of a speedometer dial that shows progress towards good and where areas might need some work, it is important to keep people aware of what you're doing. Slide number 96, again, is a little bit clearer version of that table showing how the 319 work plans would be extracted from your watershed management plan. All right, step six. Slide number 97, measure progress and make adjustments. Here we are going to be talking about reviewing and evaluating what you've been doing in the watershed, sharing results with others. It is good to do some reporting, whether it's biannual or annual or whenever you feel like you need to toot your horn about something good that's happening. Again, keep people informed and then adjusting. Slide number 98, just a few tips that have been given to us from people all over. Plans are guides. They're not straitjackets. Don't let your plan restrict what you're doing. If some unforeseen opportunity presents itself, it may not be in your short-term objectives. It may not be in your long-term objectives, but an objective look at this might indicate that this could really help out what you're doing. Don't be so tied to your plan that you're not going to make some use of this. Another thing that's not on here is the sort of paralysis by analysis situation where people aren't comfortable moving forward. They always want more data and so forth. And it's helpful to remember that people make major decisions in their lives, even with not a whole lot of characterization information. People get married sometimes with less characterization information than they want for the watershed to implement BMPs. So don't get too hung up on collecting data that you're not ready to move forward with implementation. Low-hanging fruit, a lot of times people are a little hesitant to do some of the easy things because it's almost too easy. But doing some of the easy things gives people a sense that something's happening, that progress is being made, and it does help to build a sense of progress and momentum. So it's actually recommended that you start out with things that are achievable. If you take on something that's too difficult, you run the risk of frustration and having people think, you know, this is just going to be too hard. It's important to start out easy and work towards the hard things. If you have issues that are very contentious and raise the temperature of the meeting room and so forth, if you can work on those privately and quietly for a while and try to get people to come together and discuss these things out of the glare of public meetings and the media and so forth, that's a really good way to go about it. When there's an audience and the issues are contentious, a lot of times people will play to the crowd and so forth. So it is good to sort of do it in a sort of a quiet and dignified way and try to find out where the areas of disagreement are and move forward from there. And then on slide 99, do it all over again. It's highly unlikely that your watershed plan is going to lay out everything that needs to be done and how much needs to be done and when and where and so forth, and it's all going to work the first time. It is going to be very much sort of a herky-jerky progress and movement towards your goals, just like everything else in life, I guess, whether it's trying to lose weight or trying to increase exercise or whatever it is. There's going to be some adjustments that need to be made along the way. These adjustments will be informed by your monitoring program. What are you finding? You've got your ear to the ground, whether it's water quality parameters or anecdotal information from maybe you've got some folks in the ag sector who are trying to implement VMPs, and they're telling you that, you know, the maintenance of this is just killing us, and we need to figure something out here. So whether it's actual data or people calling and talking to you about what's happening or things that you see yourself, it is important to track these things and try to adjust your program as you're moving forward. On slide 100, for those who like to see how everything is connected or not, there's a diagram here showing how planning is going to influence what you do, the inputs and the outputs. And then your evaluation is going to come from your outcomes and also inform how you adjust. Slide number 101, we're going to finish up here in just a second. The bottom line, your load reductions, they're going to be estimates, and it is critical to try to estimate load reductions that you're going to get from your BMPs and how far this is going to get you down the road. The idea here is to give people who are going to be involved with the effort over time some sense of proportionality. You know, do we need to deal with five or six farms in this watershed, or do we need to deal with six or seven small towns or so many areas where there's timber harvest going on, or do we need to do triple that amount? So some sense of proportionality. How much of this do we need to do? Is it going to be a little? Is it going to be a lot? How much? Preliminary information and estimates can be modified and corrected. You know, that's what the adaptive management process is all about. You're going to start out and start taking some steps towards your goal, and you may need to step a little to the side. You may need to step back every now and then and reassess and move forward again, but the idea is that you're going to adjust over time. So that's kind of where we're at. The 319 management measures will be required in a lot of cases for projects that are funded under 319. Again, reasonable estimates. Are these defensible? What are you basing these estimates on? That's sort of what we're looking for in the estimates. And then finally on slide 102, you will need patience. You're not going to do all this year or next year or maybe even, you know, a few years down the road. It's going to take some time. The idea is to start moving towards your goals and adjust as you go along and try to get others involved in the process. Thanks, Barry. As you can see by pushing your advance, we are now on the final question and answer session before we conclude today's webcast. We do have a few minutes to answer those questions, but before we do that, I'd like to first again draw everyone's attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're viewing the webcast online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. Excuse me. From there, you'll be returned to the home page, which has Charlie's, Stewart's, Leslie's, and Barry's email addresses and phone numbers. At the bottom of the home page, you will find two additional items. One is the link to additional resources, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's session. Clicking this link will direct you to several useful resources, including the DREC handbook discussed today, EPA's Nonpoint Source Pollution webpage, and EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum. The second item at the bottom of the homepage is the seminar feedback form. Again, please consider completing this form as we really do consider your comments while working to improve our webcasts. Now we have time for questions. I'll start with the one submitted online, and it looks like we have a few primarily for Charlie and Stuart. I'll start with Charlie. This one comes from Phil in Alaska, who writes, although it is relatively easy to get funding to begin this process within a watershed, it will take 5 to 10 years to accomplish the entire process. Do you have any ideas for sustainable funding options to get through years 3 through 8 when you may not be producing a pollution reduction result?
Hi, Phil. Thanks for the question. Is everyone still out there, hanging in there? That's a good question, and EPA has actually formed a team called the Sustainable Finance Team to address this issue specifically. First of all, that's one of the reasons why it's really important to continually bring in new partners, new energy, i.e. new money. And the Sustainable Finance Team, they do have a web page on EPA's website, and they are also going to be holding a webcast on February 15th called Plan to Fund, so you may want to catch that.
Thanks, Charlie. The next question comes from Gareth in Texas, who writes, the handbook appears to focus on presently impacted or impaired watersheds. What guidance can you recommend in the development of a watershed plan for a currently unimpaired watershed that is anticipated to undergo significant urbanization? I'll give this one back to Charlie.
Okay, thanks, Gareth. Good question. We deliberately, we did want to include unimpaired watersheds as well. When we talk about threatened watersheds, which I think is where you would be with urbanization happening, the framework is going to be the same for doing a watershed plan for an unimpaired watershed. What you are going to have that's different, your goals are going to be different and your targets are going to be different, and you may not be able to quantify them as readily because they won't be pollutant loadings. Also, your management measures are going to include a lot more locally based practices, such as, and you'll need to contact your local planning and zoning departments, and your strategies might be model ordinances, using low-impact development techniques, things like that. Finally, also, your partners are going to be different. You need to bring in partners that are involved in that kind of work, such as land trusts, nature conservancy, wetlands protection organizations, and preservation districts.
Thanks, Charlie. The next question appears to be suited for Stuart. Laura from New Jersey asks, are there national reference numbers for nutrients for BMP effectiveness?
Thank you. I think the answer to this question will probably also answer Sarah Tone's question from Nevada relating to BMPs for microbial contaminants. There are both ag and urban databases. The urban database has been developed for best management practices, and the ag database is under construction as we speak. These will help provide some of those numbers. I should mention that our management measures guidelines also show some efficiencies in charts and tables. Both ag, urban, and for on-site systems or septic systems. And then I need to mention that NRCS, state and local tech guides, are another important source of information, as well as getting numbers and working locally with conservation districts.
And one more from the online world. Barbara from California asks,
how does the stressor identification process relate to the analysis?
EPA's Office of Research and Development has helped us with this one a little bit. There is a tool called CADIS, which we describe in our handbook. It's a framework for helping identify the pollutant that's causing the stress in the watershed. It's a sequential decision process. You use checklists to identify the what you're seeing in the watershed and helps lead you towards the right pollutants. Once you do that, that helps with selecting the appropriate models, finding the data necessary to make decisions, and then moving forward with some kind of control.
Great. Thanks, Stuart. At this point, do I dare open the phone lines up again? I'm going to unmute the lines, and if you do have a question, I ask you to identify yourself and wait to be acknowledged, and then we'll ask you to go ahead and ask your question. Phone lines are unmuted. Any questions out there? Any questions at all, except related to chiropractic work?
Mark Tomasek from Minnesota.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Mark Tomasek from Minnesota.
Let's go ahead, Mark.
I'm wondering, the plan tends to look at a planning horizon in the past and what's going on now, and I didn't hear much discussion about looking into the future for its watershed changes or point source load increases with expansion. I'm wondering if there's any thought or discussion on what type of planning horizon you might look into the future, where it's 5, 10, 20 years, or if that's kind of open-ended.
I'll point to Leslie and ask her to answer that question.
Thank you for the question. I think it's an excellent point, and there is a site-specific nature, as you kind of point to, that it depends on how fast the area is changing and what the likelihood is, either there would be increases in point source loadings, changes in land use or conversion of land use from rural to urban land, and or any other significant changes that might occur, as in the CSO management program or the removal of some of the major sources that occur, like the closure of a point source discharger. And there is an aspect, especially when you look at the loading analysis and the modeling and as it relates to the analysis of the watershed, there is an opportunity where you can do forecasts of what the conditions might be under various future land use conditions. And watershed planning, as well as the all the different programs we looked at, all have an interest in making sure that that plan is sustainable and adaptive over time. So the adaptive concept does bring in the idea that you would want to forecast what the problem might be and then make sure that your plan is adapts to that problem or has milestones that would address the various changes that would happen in the future.
Thanks, Leslie. We have time for one more quick question. Is there any other questions? Are there any other questions out there? Okay, with that, at this time I'd like to conclude today's webcast, and especially like to thank Charlie, Stuart, Leslie, and Barry for their wonderful presentations today. And of course, thanks to everyone who joined us via the internet and over the phone. Again, a reminder, please visit EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum at www.epa/watershedforum to discuss more issues related to the draft handbook. The forum has a number of discussion threads, including one on watershed planning tools. We also encourage folks to return to www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts. There you'll find notices about upcoming webcasts. Our next webcast will be February 15th. Bill Jirocki will give a seminar on Plan to Fund, a watershed planning tool that helps organizations determine their funding needs and meet the goals and objectives of their watershed program plans. Again, that ends our webcast for today. Thank you very much.